Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Ruler podcast. I'm Ian Parkinson. This is podcast 17.3, which, like the magazine, is marking the 100th edition of the Giro d'Italia. We'll be hearing from a variety of pros and former pros on their experiences chasing the Maglia Rosa. And we have a fascinating interview with the always inventive Graham O'Bree, still a legend and a maverick, nearly 25 years since he first broke the world hour record. Plus, of course, the Ruler competition. Well, the centenary Giro begins in Sardinia before island hopping to Sicily, including a summit finish on Etna, before working its way up from the very tip of Italy's toe to a finish in Milan. There are those who'll tell you that the Giro is the true essence of road racing. The Tour de France sucks up all the attention and glory, but the Giro is for the true connoisseur, the genuine tifosi. David Miller rode it 5 times, won 2 stages, and wore the pink jersey. But his memories are nuanced.
Well, it's Italian for starters, so it's chaotic. Yeah, the Giro is just, it's Italian, isn't it? But if you know Italian, you know how things are organised in Italy, it always is a little bit haphazard and a bit autocratic, but without any decent autocratic organisation. It's a very mad place, which in many circumstances can be charming, but not in the Giro d'Italia. I don't find it so charming when you're doing 250k stages back to back with 6,000 metres climbing in the final few days of a Grand Tour. They would just make it more and more. You know what it's like when you do the Giro? It feels like you're part of a circus and you're one of the animals. The other races, it feels like you're working together, whereas the Giro, you feel like you're an animal in a circus. Yeah, that's a big difference.
You must have some fond memories of the Giro, though. Or maybe not.
No, I've only got one. The Giro was never really kind of did it for me. But it's just the time trial stage I won in 2011. That was the final day, and my friend Nadav was there, and he followed the whole day. And that was quite a magical day, actually. Yeah, I remember that vividly. And yeah, so that's my fondest memory. That's kind of, I should have never gone back. I went back in 2013 and had a horrible 12 days. Yeah.
David Miller. Jens Vogt rode the Giro 3 times. He's a little more enthusiastic.
The Giro is just a different race. I won't even go that far to say, in terms of profile, the Giro is harder than the Tour. The difference is just in the Tour de France, you have probably 10 people you want to go for a win. In the Giro, you have 3 people you want to win. In the Tour de France, you have 150 riders you want to win a stage. In the Giro, maybe you have 20 riders you want to win a stage. The pressure is a little less. But in terms of pure profile and altitude and the length of the stages and all that, I would say it's a little harder than the Tour de France. And having a leader with Ivan Basso in the Maglia Rosa, there was a bit of pressure on us, of course. But we managed to pull it off, and it was a good event.
What are the Italian fans like? What's the experience of riding the Giro like compared, say, to the Tour de France?
Well, the Tour de France sometimes you feel in some corner it's the Tour of Britain, the next corner the Tour of the US or the Tour of Australia. It's kind of like almost hard to find a French supporter anymore these days. You know, the Tour de France is such an international event. I mean, keep in mind, the Tour de France is the biggest yearly happening sports event in the world. Only every 4 years it gets topped by the Soccer World Cup or the Olympic Games. We are bigger than the Formula One Grand Prix in Monaco. We are bigger than the Super Bowl. We are you know, the biggest sporting event in the world, and it's super international. The Giro d'Italia, you have a lot more Italian fans, and everybody speaks Italian, and they're like full of enthusiasm and passion. And as far as I can see, they're very, very fair fans. They cheer you up if you're winning the stage, or if you're dead last, they still yell at you and support you. I love that.
Alex Dowsett is another Giro stage winner, taking a time trial stage on his debut. Unlike a lot of pros, Alex didn't spend his childhood dreaming of exploits in the Alps and the Dolomites.
When I was a kid, I wanted to be a race car driver. Cycling didn't really register as a career move until... something I wanted to do in life until I got second to Ian Stannard in the schoolboys 10-mile national finals. I was 14 and everyone else in the top 10 was 16, so that for me, as a kid, because of my haemophilia and what I wasn't allowed to do in school in terms of football and rugby, I wanted to create a mentality that we see in a lot of young haemophiliacs now, that you want to excel at something. Some rebel and just play football and rugby anyway and perhaps suffer the consequences, but they're lucky with the parents that they have, and like I was lucky with mine, and just saw that desire to do sport and be very good at something, and and just sort of nudged me in the right direction. And when I was 13, I started cycling, and I realised a year later that was what I was very good at and had the potential to be kind of world class at. And then subsequently, obviously, fell in love with it as well. But cycling wasn't something that registered. I wasn't like Swifty where I was doing my first bike race at 2.5 years old. It was,
So when you did actually, 2013, wasn't it? The Giro was your first Grand Tour. When you actually went there, did it live up to your expectations? You did very well in the first year, but did it live up to your expectations as an event?
No. It, like a lot of things, I think people like to scaremonger, so I was expecting it to be horrific. And it was just mostly unpleasant in terms of how hard it was. So it was kind of a pleasant surprise in the end, and you can kind of enjoy it in a weird sort of masochistic way. It helped that I was in good shape. There was only one point in the Giro where I was like, oh, I might not finish this because I'm struggling. And obviously to get the stage win under my belt was huge and unexpected. It was a great experience, actually. And three and a half weeks of your life, you just hand over to your team. You are away, cut off from the outside world a bit, and it's a weird kind of existence.
We hear a lot about the sort of fanaticism and the enthusiasm of the fans in Italy. Did you experience that at all firsthand? What were the crowds like in Italy?
Yeah, they were big. They were really big. They were no bigger than we get in the Tour of Britain, though. So it was a great experience. And I was lucky that my family came out for the time trial, which was just made it an unforgettable day. But they're out up the cold mountains in the snow, braving it out, and it's great because you need that. You do need that support when things are getting real tough.
A month after the winner of the Giro crosses the line in Milan, the women's version, the Giro Rosa or Giro Donne, gets underway near Trieste. It'll finish 10 stages later near Naples. It's the most important race on the women's pro calendar, and Megan Garnier of Bols Dolmans, last year's Women's World Tour winner, is looking forward to it. So when you came to Europe in 2008 for the first time and started racing over here, how much of a sort of culture shock was that to you, in particular, the racing?
Yeah, I had just begun cycling, and I've made it no secret that I don't know if I finished a single race during that first campaign, my first campaign over here. It was really difficult, and that can either make or break you. And I came out of that first trip and said to myself, I want to be the women at the front of the peloton. I don't know what they're doing up there, but I want to be one of those women at the front making the race and making it hard for people like me in the back, because I don't know if I ever saw the front of the race in 2008. So,
in 2009, you rode the Giro Rosa for the first time. And again, what kind of an experience was that? Because that's a very different race, isn't it?
Yeah. In 2009, I think it was just about surviving and learning again, at that point, you're just in the learning phase and learning the race and what goes into racing that many days back to back. And it's definitely an experience and a shock to the system.
And what was it like the riding in Italy, you know, in many ways the sort of one of the great centres of cycling? What was the that's Laura Trott running past it. What's the atmosphere like on a substantial stage race in Italy like the Giro Rosa?
Yeah, I love racing in Italy. I love racing, especially the Giro Rosa. One of the best things about it is the food. And because you always know you're going to get a good meal at the end of the day. And of course, the terrain is beautiful and the courses are always extremely challenging. And that's what makes racing in Italy such an amazing and beautiful part of the season.
Megan Garnier. Away from the Giro now to a true legend of cycling. There are those who invest millions in technology and research who micromanage every inch of the production and preparation process. And then there's Graham Abree. Twice world pursuit champion, twice breaker of the world record, always a maverick, always compelling company. I caught up with him at the Ruler Classic to get his take on the state of cycling technology and much more.
Well, actually, I'm not that bothered about technology having moved on from my era, because what I got was I was the best in my era. When you look at the advancements, for example, not name dropping specifically, but if you look at the skin suits and the aerodynamics that Endura, which I'm involved in, and Alex Dowsett used to great effect, and the huge difference that's made in terms of wattages to go at the same pace, then those weren't available in my era. But I competed in a level playing field in that era. So when I see the bikes, it's in a way, there's two things happen with bikes. One, they've improved almost to the point of the maximum possibility for the regulations. You can't see very much improvement unless the rules change, and then they would gravitate to maximum for that new rule. So pretty much what's happened is you probably pick 10 bikes and the difference between them would be very little now, which is good if you want a level playing field and it to be accessible. That's very good. I didn't have them in my era, but that's okay.
If you could only sort of change one rule that currently affects bike technology in races, what would it be? What's the one thing you think, why do they still do that?
The one thing I look at is team pursuit, because I like things that can really get your teeth into. I can never understand why do they not use the smallest possible wheels, the smallest possible wheelbase, because the length of the entire team matters in terms of how much energy has to be changed and then drop of pace and then speed of pace. Okay, using the track to conserve momentum, but nonetheless, the size of the sweep and the other three riders past the first rider, the amount of aerodynamic assistance then depends on the whole length of the team. So if you get a 700c wheel, then why would you not, if you're allowed a 650, why would you not have 650? And if you're allowed the wheel to be tucked right up against the bottom bracket shell, why would you not have that specifically for the team pursuit? That's one thing. Well, that was one thing you asked me.
Give us another one then, because that's fascinating. So give us another one.
Well, you know what, actually, I think what's happened in 20 years since I was at Cutting Edge is so much has happened. We now live in an exciting age where things are improving in terms of clothing rather than bikes. But I still see people who don't, especially triathletes, people who come from the triathlon side, people not maximising their positional opportunities. When you consider the change of a position, the hand position, the elbow positions, even the seat angle, racing bikes seem really, really steep seat angles. But I've gravitated going further and further back in the saddle. It was Sean Kelly started going on to this. He said, "Goes, why don't you put that saddle back to get more power?" And I thought, oh, well, there's a thought. If it comes from Sean, I'm going to try that out. That pushed me into changing my pedal stroke. I talked about quite a lot of that stuff in the on-training manual, which does need updated. But people who have glaring opportunities to change, but changes that could be made rather than just buying money for equipment when there's a glaring opportunity is just for physical change of positioning that would make such a difference?
It does seem to have got to a point now where the sort of thing that you were doing, i.e. experimenting in your home and, you know, trying things out, building your own bikes, that it's got to a level now where that's almost impossible, isn't it?
Well, I don't believe it is. There is an nth degree where it's almost like carving something out of a piece of stone. The first bit, you're hacking chunks of rock out of it. But an amateur could hack chunks of rock out of a bare stone to get a rough outline. Now, a lot of people could get to that by the feel factor and being willing to change things up and down. Saddle height, crank length. I mean, if you're 5 in new money, if you're 165 metres tall, then you shouldn't, this is affects lady riders more than anybody, you should not be using 170 cranks. Pro rata, you should be using 160s, 155s, in terms of everything being in line with the bone structure and scale with the length that it should be to scale your body. But you don't see that. You see people using inappropriate crank lengths, inappropriate handlebar widths. So there's a whole lot of chopping and changing you could do to experiment for your body size and body form, and honing down to roughly a position that suits you, getting close to it. Then go to bike fit people and goes, I've honed this down as best I can. Can you hone it further for me? But there's a whole lot of honing that people could do on their own on the basis that if it feels right, it probably is right.
That sounds a little bit like the sort of much-discussed marginal gains, you know, the tiny little changes once everyone's got to the same sort of playing field.
Well, marginal gains is down to the real experts, of which I've been out of touch with that very, very finery, the very fine tune. But the whole big chunks can actually come with experimentation. And you could even use the roll-down technique, the old-fashioned roll-down technique. You roll down a hill or just... not pedalling, but rolling down a hill and moving stuff about and goes, oh, yeah, that... You'd even time yourself down hills and try different handlebar positions and stuff. Get a rough idea in whole seconds of what's making a difference aerodynamically. Then once you get hone it down to a certain level, he goes, OK, that's as far as I can do with the rough bit of it. And then turn up with as much as you can do yourself and then go... So you've made a good start to the right direction before the fine honing.
In addition to your sort of experimenting with the bike and the position, you were a bit of a pioneer in terms of training as well, weren't you? You were a pioneer in particular in the use of sort of things like turbo trainers.
Well, I became absolutely obsessed for the very real reason that I wanted a turbo trainer to be made or change my turbo trainer and cut bits off of it, literally. Take wind aspects off of it because the air pressure could change, being that particular about it. Let's say the pressure can go from 1,040 down to 960 or something. It's a 10% difference. So if you're using something that uses air resistance as a resistance, you've got a 10% change there. So I took it out, totally relied on magnetic resistance, cut any adjustment out of it, locked it, literally locked it in place so that turbo trainer is the same every time, the same pump to pump the tyres up. And I'm pretty convinced I got my turbo trainer and tyre pump and pump set up to know that when I'm going on that turbo trainer, then if I compare to what I did before, then it's within 0.25%. Now, we all know what it's like. If let's say you're doing a 20-minute session, you get to 18 minutes, it goes, I'm physically going to die. And if there's an inkling in your mind, you know what, the air pressure's changed or something, if I'm putting that amount of effort in to, suppose I'm trying to do a session that's 0.5% better, because that's what it comes down to, half percentages over the course of 10 or 15 weeks. And you add up 15 half percentages. Now, that turns you into a top amateur to a world beater. But you've got to know, if the floor's coming up and down, you think you're going to die in that last 2 minutes, you ought to know you're getting that 0.5%. But it doesn't actually matter about the wattage. I didn't care about the wattage. What I cared about was, I ended up with a book. I've still got it, my wee red book, that tells me, and I've still got the turbo trainer, by the way, locked. And if I was daft enough to make a comeback, I would know what I would have to do in a standard computer, cheap as you like, set to 700C, what I would have to do on that computer, on that turbo trainer, to do a 19-minute 10 or to do X number of kilometres on the track. what I've created is a totally reliable index for me. So what I get is year after year, I can go in the same turbo trainer, and I know what my, that turbo trainer never lies. You think you're going good, and the turbo trainer tells you, hold on, you're kidding yourself, and the turbo trainer never lies.
I was talking to Matt Stevens this morning, and he recalled the Pursuit Championships, which you were both at a World Championships, and he remembered seeing you just going on your turbo trainer for 5 minutes and then getting off it again, and then maybe coming back a bit later and doing another 5 minutes, because you thought that actually 5 minutes was what you needed to do because you were going for an individual pursuit.
Just that statement made you think, well, that guy didn't train very hard. But actually, I won a World Championships in 9 minutes. In my mind, you don't see the mental contortations for me actually trying to visualise actually being in the start line, being in the start gate. And before I even start my 5 minutes, I'm actually counting down in my head, oh, beep, 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 and then bang, I'm off. And it wasn't 5 minutes, it was 4.5 minutes. Exactly 4.5 minutes, because that's long it takes me to win a World Championship. And I've got to pretend that the laps are going down and it's got to be so hard, and that has to replicate the effort that I would need. Because let's face it, specific training for specific recovery, for specific adaptation, for a specific result, was totally what I was aiming for.
And that was almost unheard of at the time that you were doing that. That sort of training on the turbo trainer, and imagining how you were doing it. And nowadays, I guess, with the advances in technology and the advances in training, that's actually quite commonplace.
Well, it is commonplace. And I was huge into visualisation. Like on my own, actually, had my turbo trainer in an old coal shed. Deliberately in the coal shed, because it was just walls beside me. Almost like it was like a horse. And one of those boxes before it starts the race, and it was just white. There was nothing. There was a fan in front of me. There was a cassette player, which actually I wouldn't play until the last 17. If I can get to 17 minutes, then I can play Don't Stop Me Now by Queen blasting out. Just to hang on to my last 20 minutes for doing a 20-minute session, because the 20-minute session was very important to me. Because no matter what, 20 minutes is what builds up that aerobic base, because everything comes from my aerobic base, whether it's pursuing or doing longer distance, that absolute low aerobic base. And if, in my mind, it takes a minimum of 20 minutes to get into that state where you're stimulating that, your heart, your lungs, to be an aerobic beast. And then the anaerobic and the extras round about that is built in that. And that half percentage, if I'm in the coal hole playing Don't Stop Me Now, just to hang on, and I can hardly see the floors coming up and down at me, and I think I'm going to die, I want to know I'm getting my 0.5%, and that's why it's so important to be exactly the same measured machine every week.
Can we talk about doping? I remember seeing you talking at an event years ago now, where you said that the worst thing about doping was that it had taken away that sense of wonder which we used to have about cyclists and their efforts, because unfortunately now there was always going to be that sort of in your mind, it's amazing, but is it too amazing?
Well, it's unfortunate that you can't take away that element of doubt. I mean, now what you've got is the blood passports and everything. You can't say it's not possible for somebody to cheat now, because it's been shown that that's not the case. I mean, people can still take EPO with impunity. They just can't take as much of it because of the spike thing, but people can still take some of it. So, and blood doping still can't be caught, in terms of you put blood in your freezer and then, or your fridge or whatever it is they do, and then put some of it back in. So you can't discount the fact that somebody would do it. But I like to take it in face value, because if I don't take it in face value, then I'm not watching it at all. It goes, as far as I'm concerned, what I see is how it went down. Because otherwise it's taking away my enjoyment of sport. And that's it. And because amazing athletes do amazing things now and again. And that's what we live for. Just that you watch it thinking this could be an amazing moment. If you think you're never going to be any more amazing moments, where would you watch sport for? You watch it for the excitement. For the whole, just that feel-good wow factor. And that's instant. And that's why I never watch sport on pre-record. I never watched it in pre-recorded. I think it was that amazing that I heard about it, so I don't want to watch it. And there's that, I don't know, maybe it's a personal thing. I feel that it's gone already. Even if it's me just seeing it for the first time, it's gone into the biosphere of knowledge. I want to see it this instant for that hit of it. It's got to be live and right now, and anything could happen. Like, when Chris Froome was running up up the mountain with his shoes and everything, that was, I watching that in real time, it's like, wow, this is happening right now. You know that feel of right now? And I was like, wow, and what's going to happen next? And the whole excitement of it is just, you know, because it's got to be right now. And that buzz that sport gives you. And I refuse to have that taken away from me, because I, as far as I'm concerned, what I see is what I get. And if I'm proven wrong and I'm like, oh, I'm just disappointed, but I refuse to let it change my enjoyment of it.
So what does the next year or so hold for you? What plans have you got?
Well, it's kind of like asking somebody at the end of the First World War what their plans for the military career is. Well, the whole Beastie project with this squashed beluga, the whole project and filming, and I'm emotionally and spiritually drained because, oh, God, I don't have any energy for anything. I do have some writing projects. I finished, but it's not a secret that I kind of lost the plot for a decade, quite seriously. And it's not like that anymore. No medication, no depressions and stuff like that, because I've changed so much, and I've written a book called Enough, which I'm just... it's not good enough because I goes, oh, good enough, just publish it, because I was fed up talking and writing about it, but it needs one more going over, and then it'll be out. So that's a project. I was so long away with that Beastie project. I'm almost needing thinking time. It is nice to have some challenge. I do have a writing challenge, but I'm thinking... And I do love cycling. I love a good punter in the countryside. And it's nice not having a challenge because, for the simple reason, there's no reason I have to be blasting up a hill or going that hard, because some future time I'll have to prove myself or have to be impressive to somebody. There's absolutely nothing lined up in the future. And, like, I was out yesterday, and this is we're talking now at the show. I was out yesterday, good blast, because I wanted to. Just because I wanted to. I could go as fast as I don't need to be fit for anything again, but I wanted to. Right now is the right now aspect I've got back in cycling, and just for the passion of it, because I love, you know, that feeling of you're breathing and you're beautiful roads and hills and just the right now of it is what I live for. And in fact, I actually moved to the house that I live in specifically because it goes straight to the countryside. I can do a 2 or 3 hour bike ride, zero traffic lights. I can go to 1,000 feet 4 times in country roads and hardly pass 10 cars. I moved there specifically for a bike ride. First priorities. That's it. First priorities, bike riding. And I'll go as far as to say, I avoid car ownership. I avoid things of great expense, expensive hobbies, because that would involve further work that's time that could be riding a bike. That is my priorities. Cheap out, living near the countryside, ride your bike because you love it.
Sounds like a very sensible philosophy. Graham Mowbray, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
So all that remains is the Ruler competition, starting with the results from podcast 17.2. We asked you to work out the missing rider's name from Ned Bolting's feature on Tim Harris. The prize was a fine Ruler sweatshirt. And the paragraph in question was, the house has produced a number of British road race champions, including blank, who prepared for his victory by sitting up till 3 o'clock in the morning, smoking cigars, drinking brandy and eating Spanish ham with Adam Blythe. The answer, of course, was Rob Hales, and the winner was Mark Cousins from Norfolk. The question this time is, Felice Gimondi won all 3 Grand Tours by the age of 25. Who was the only other rider at that time, which was 1968, to have accomplished that feat? The winner gets a pink Ruler cap and matching pink musette. To enter, go to the editorial section of the Ruler website, find the page for the podcast,
All the details are there. Well, that's it from this edition, although we can't go without mentioning the winner of the 2011 Giro, Michele Scarponi. A huge and much-loved character, the kind of man that pro cycling can ill afford to lose. The reaction of his fellow professionals, the fans and team staff to his death speaks volumes about the sort of person he was. Catch you next time. Be careful out there.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.